Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hello listeners, and welcome to this week's episode of The Colt Vault. Happy New Year to you all. I hope you celebrated safely but in style. And I hope that 2021 brings happiness and good health. Thank you all so much for your continued support as this podcast moves into 2021 alongside you all. To kickstart this year, I have a very special episode. I will be sharing an interview I did with cult expert and leading figure in this industry, Janja Lalić. I've been excited to share this episode with all of you, and I hope you all enjoy it as much as I have. So hi, Janja, and thank you so much for joining me today. I am so excited to be able to sit here and talk to somebody who is such a leading figure in this field. I'm sure that the majority of the listeners know exactly who you are. I'm sure some of them have even read or watched some of your material. But for those who might not know, would you like to introduce yourself?
Sure. And thanks for having me. This is really a wonderful occasion. So my name is Janja Lalić, and I have a PhD. I'm a retired professor emeritus of sociology. I am an expert in the field of cults and coercion. I got to this because I myself was in a cult in the 70s and 80s. And after I got out and got my brain back together, I went to grad school and got my PhD. And so I've spent, I'd say, the last 30 some years writing books to help primarily to help survivors, but also for families and professionals. I've done a lot of interviews and speaking and have run support groups for former cult members and just kind of the whole gamut of things. My experience wasn't great, and so I sort of look at it as turning a bad thing into a good thing and using that experience and then my studies afterwards combined with that to hopefully, you know, bring some help to survivors, but also to educate the public.
And I think that it's safe to say that that's exactly what you've been able to do through all of the work that you've done over your career. There's such a wealth of information that you've put out for, you know, in books. There's loads of documentaries. There's so much stuff that I think goes hand in hand with what you've just said. You know, you've had this experience and you've come out of the other side of it, and now you're able to help people who may be going through something similar. And I just think that's absolutely incredible.
Thank you.
And after having such a lengthy career in the same field, do you feel like you're still learning? Do you still have experiences that you think, oh, that's something new for me that I wasn't sure about before?
Oh yes. I mean, first of all, I hear about new cults practically every day. People email me through my website or contact me in some way. And so I'm constantly learning about new groups, both here in the United States, but in all countries. And sort of learning about sort of the new ways that cult leaders find to manipulate and exploit their members. You know, recently there was the case of Nexium, which I don't know if everyone there followed that, but the so-called sex cult in New York. And, you know, I have to say that cult leader was one of the most brutal that I'd ever heard of. And so, yeah, I'm constantly amazed. It never gets old. It's sometimes daunting and it's sometimes sad and troubling. You know, it's a difficult field to work in. But, you know, here I am.
And it's interesting that you mentioned Nexium, because that was something that I was going to bring up a bit later on. When I mentioned the documentaries that you've been involved in, there was one that was released recently, which was, I'm not sure if it was part of a series, but it's a number of documentaries that you have done on the same cult movement.
Are you talking about Seduced?
Yes.
Yes, Seduced, it was a recent documentary specifically on the Nexium cult and India Oxenberg's experience with that. It's a four-part documentary on the Starz channel, which I believe people over there have access to. I know my friends over there have watched it. The director is Cecilia Peck, who was Gregory Peck's daughter. So for me, it was quite an honor to meet and
wow, yeah,
and be in that house, you know, filled with all this memorabilia of her dad. And so that was pretty exciting for me. But it's really gotten rave reviews. It's an excellent documentary.
Yes, it has. Absolutely. Yeah, that was something I was going to mention towards the end. If anybody would be more interested in watching Janya in action, then that's definitely one of the things I'd recommend. But that's you say it's interesting, you know, being able to work with other people, but I bet they found it fascinating to be able to work with you as well.
I suppose so, but I always feel kind of funny about that. You know, I laugh at people who say, you know, I'm your number one fan. And I'm like, oh, please, you know, I'm just trying to do what I can do. You
know? I think it's really interesting that that social sciences there's like celebrities within, you know, because mental health and all of the things that come with that, it's taken such a long time for us to proactively move towards, you know, a place that's safe and secure for people to discuss mental health and to have an open mind about mental health. And then people are saying that they're your number one fan, and it's like the social sciences are winning, which is just awesome. I just think that's great. So the word cult, when I first started this podcast, my first episode was looking at the word, the etymology, the history behind the word. I actually used yourself as a reference in the explained episode that you're involved in when looking at what quantifies and qualifies a cult. And I know that new religious movement is the term that some academics might prefer to use. I do get that email occasionally myself. But I mean, it's really complex, and I couldn't find anything that sums it up in a nice little one sentence or bow. I mean, what would you say are the basic bullet points when you look for indications that a group or movement is a cult?
Well, you know, there's always the authoritarian, you know, so-called charismatic leader who demands all loyalty and devotion. Then for me, there is what I call the transcendent belief system. This person has an ideology which offers you the answer to the past, present, and future, which is why I call it a transcendent belief system. And And the crucial part is, not only does it offer you this belief system and a promise of some sort of salvation that may or may not be religious, but it also requires you to go through a personal transformation in order to be on that path and in order to be accepted as a follower. And then for me, the clincher are what I call the systems of influence and control. And by that, I mean, those are basically the mechanisms that both bring that transformation about, the indoctrination system, right? And so the controls and the influences that make that happen, that excuse me, that bind you to the group. One thing I'd like to mention for people who want kind of a brief little animation on this is, a while back I did the script for a TED Ed animation on what is a cult. So TED Ed is the educational component of the TED Talks, which people have probably heard of. So if you go to TEDed.com and just type in my name, it should come up. And it's a little 3-minute brilliant animation done by this guy in Colombia. I wrote the script, he did the animation. And of course the TED Ed folks, you know, checked it all along the way. And it's, you know, been shown all over the world. It's been watched millions of times. I'm really very proud of it. So it's a quick way for people to get, you know, get a handle on the terminology.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic. I'll pop that link in the show notes as well for anybody that would be interested in going and taking a look. And we will post it on our social media pages too. Sure.
Thank you.
And when you mentioned before about people emailing to your website, one thing I usually find when I'm scrolling through the subreddit, the cult subreddit on Reddit, it is people will post almost daily things like, is my friend in a cult? Think there's a cult in my town. Are these the types of requests that come through your website?
Yes. I mean, it's everything from that kind of question, you know, my spouse, my best friend, my nephew, whatever, you know, I think they're involved in something, or the person may know, they may even know the name of the group, you know, and what can I do? Where can I find help? Mm-hmm. Or it might be, you know, professionals seeking advice or lawyers looking for expert witness. But the bulk of the queries I get are from the general public, people from literally all around the world. And then I try to help them in whatever way I can, direct them to information or direct them to resources or other individuals who I think can help them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was exactly going to be my next question. What advice would you offer if someone suspects they could be getting involved in a cult themselves?
If the person thinks they're getting involved.
Yeah, or somebody close to them approaches you and says that they're worried about a loved one.
Yeah. There are a couple of things. If it's somebody you're close with, the most important thing is to try to stay in touch with that person. Don't alienate the person. So don't confront them. Don't say, oh, you're in a cult, you know, because that's just going to chase them away. I always say to friends and families, like, always leave the door open. Always present yourself as a safe haven for that person. Because if and when they decide to believe, to leave, it's the hardest thing they're ever going to do. And they need to know there's a safe place they can go to where people aren't going to like chastise them or make fun of them or say, see, I told you so, you know, so important to stay in touch. And then, you know, depending on what they know, I would say doing some research is the next important thing to do. Like, find out all you can about the group, try to find former members who were in that group who can tell you about their experiences, or professionals who've worked with people from that group. There's so much information today on the internet, which is one of the really good things about the internet. I know some cults recruit through the internet, but also many former cult members have put out information and websites and different things for people to really get a handle on what they're looking at. So finding out information and then you have a choice. You can kind of ride it out, see if the person gets disenchanted and leaves, or you can you can plan an intervention, which is tricky and is expensive. So not, you know, obviously not everyone can afford to do that.
And are interventions something that you have had experience with in your career?
I have done a few way back in the day. I'd say in the early 90s. I did a few because I wanted to see what that was like so that I could, you know, talk about it from firsthand experience. I had a very hard time doing them. I was always so nervous the night before. I'd be like throwing up in my hotel room because, you know, you're basically about to kind of rip the rug out from under somebody. So you have to really feel confident in what you're doing. So that I really applaud the people, you know, those who are ethical and honest and experienced who do the interventions, because it's very tough work.
Yeah.
And I think if people decide to go that route, they have to choose very wisely who they're going to work with.
It sounds very stressful. I'm not surprised to hear that you're not still, you know, participating in interventions all these years later. But did you find that the ones that you did take part in had some level of success?
Well, one in particular that I can mention, I think it was the first one I did. I was working with a family whose daughter was in a political cult here in California, and she had dropped out of college, a very well-known university, to be in this group. And they had another daughter, and that daughter, who was older than her sister, that daughter committed suicide.
Oh my goodness.
And so they were going to have the funeral in Hawaii. And they came back to me and said, you know, they're allowing our daughter to come to Hawaii for the funeral, so we want to do the intervention. And we advised them against it. We said, look, you know, this is going to be a really stressful emotional time, we don't recommend it. But they insisted. They said it's the only way we can make sense out of our other daughter's death. So we flew to Hawaii. We were waiting at her aunt's house. She came over to her aunt's house.
Oh my goodness, that sounds
it was after the funeral, but you know, a day or two after the funeral, she came to her aunt's house. They introduced us. We started talking to her. I'd say we were able to talk to her for about a half an hour. When she got up, ran out of the house, ran down, was up in some hill, ran down to the street, got into a phone booth. This is in the days of phone booths. I don't know if you still have them in England, but we don't have them anymore.
Yeah, we have the red phone boxes. Yeah. Red
phones. Yes, I love those. Anyway, she got herself into a phone booth. She called the police and said she was being held against her will, which of course she wasn't. And she called her cult and they bought her a ticket. And when the police arrived, she had them take her to the airport and she flew back home to California.
Oh,
back
my
to the
goodness.
Cult. So that was upsetting and hard for the family and hard for us. But what happened is about 6 months later, she left the group.
Okay.
And
so
actually,
some seed of doubt must have remained.
Whatever little bit we were able to say to her in that half hour stayed in her brain. She started to see things a little differently when she got back, and you know, things started to click for her, and she up and left the cult. And so in the end, it was a positive experience.
Fantastic. So that's just one small way that if anybody was thinking about kind of doing some level of intervention or looking for ways to support or plant their own little seed of doubt in a loved one's mind, you know, and when they go back, that's one example of how the effect could still happen, but it might just take a little bit of time.
Right. And that's why I always tell families or friends to stay in touch if you can. I mean, some groups are completely cut off and sequestered and you're not able to. But if you can, you know, send the person reminders of times together, send them photos of, you know, family Christmases or trips you took together or, you know, a cousin's wedding, whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, remind them that they had a family, that they had good times, that you were their best friend, that you traveled together, whatever it is. If you go somewhere, send that person a postcard. I wish you were here. All of those things hopefully will seep in. And, you know, the way I look at it is, I would say probably 99.9% of people in cults have doubts almost all along the way. I know I did, and I was, certainly a true believer. And you have these doubts, and the way we've been describing it is that they kind of pile up on a shelf in the back of your head. And one day there's going to be just one more piece of information or one more incident that happens that breaks that shelf. And then you know, oh, there's something wrong here. You may not think of it as a cult. You may just think, this is a bad organization, mm-hmm, or this mm-hmm. isn't right. And then you start to plan your way out. So if you can plant those seeds, that's a really important thing to do.
That's really, really good advice. And it's a nice metaphor as well. It's easy to visualize and to remember in times that are probably very anxiety inducing and isolating and lonely. So that's wonderful. That's great advice. And you mentioned before about maybe lawyers getting in touch through your website. So have you ever appeared as an expert witness?
Yes, I have a number of times.
Wow, that's fascinating.
Yeah, it's very difficult work. When you have to be in depositions, they just want to destroy you and, do whatever they can to, bring up, find stuff in your past, whatever. But I actually really love doing expert witness work because, well, for one, I love doing, in most cases, I have to write a report, an expert report. And so I love doing the analysis that goes with, writing that report to try mm-hmm. to show my, my opinion, how the foundation of my opinion. And then, I really love being able to be part of someone getting justice for whatever their experience was, whether it's
absolutely.
Getting their money back, whether it's getting someone convicted, whatever it might be. It just feels good to be able to help on that end of things, because it's not often that we do see justice in these cases.
No, I was just having an interview yesterday with a lady who was, she attended a place called the Monarch School, which has been identified as part of the troubled teen industry. And she was explaining her experiences. So I'm covering the troubled teen industry for December. And she was explaining some of her experiences. And we were just talking about how the Breaking Code Silence movement is picking up traction now. And people are talking about it and people are coming forward. But she had reservations and worries about whether there would ever be any actual justice and what would need to happen for the legal process to or people to become involved, for policies to be changed and these types of schools that are still running, for them to no longer be allowed to, as we were saying, make billions off the backs of institutionalized child abuse.
Yes, absolutely.
So there is, I mean, it must be appealing for you to be able to go in the courtroom and offer your opinion and, and make these small changes on the big surface area, but huge life changing moments for the people in those courtrooms. That's great. That's fantastic.
And insofar as they involve the cult leader, it's wonderful to see a cult leader being held accountable.
Well, yeah, I was surprised that they actually convicted the leader of Nexium. But his sentence, because I don't know if it's because obviously I'm no expert whatsoever, and a lot of the research that I've done has been through speaking with ex-members of these movements, mm-hmm. or through more historical cases. I've just done some extensive research on Rock Terrio and the Anthill Kids.
Oh, wow.
And I was just thinking to myself,
that was a horrible group.
horrible, horrible, awful, just absolutely harrowing. But I find that when we talk about cults on a wide scale to the general public, if I say, oh, you know, I, this is the podcast I do, and people are like, oh yeah, Jim Jones, and I'm like, well, no, because it's it's much more intricate and bigger than that. But somebody, I suppose that the really bad ones throughout history have always died before they've been in front of a court or being able to receive you know, justice through the legal system. So I suppose when he was sentenced, I was like, oh, there's actually, there goes one to prison where he should, you know, spend the rest of his life.
120 years.
Plus, you know,
bumped off first, right?
Yeah, exactly. Oh yeah, well, there is that as well. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, I mean, there have been cases that, you know, that have been successful, and also in the troubled teen industry, you know, years ago, the cases against Straight and the kids of New Jersey, there were some important cases. But yeah, holding these leaders accountable, it's been difficult because you have to find the evidence. You have to bring evidence to the police or to the FBI, which was what was so important in the NXIVM case, them, you know, compiling all that evidence to bring to the FBI so that they had really solid, you know, these seven federal mm-hmm. charges.
Mm-hmm.
And the other side, there's several other sides to it. The one side is, of course, it's really difficult as a victim to go through that, because you know you'll be raked through the coals, and mm-hmm. they're going to drag you, you know, through everything, and mm-hmm. you have to relive it over and over and over, and it's not easy. And so a lot of people just don't want to do that. They just want to get on with their lives. And then the other side of it is that there aren't many attorneys who will take those cases. I actually wrote an article about this that's on my website that I presented at a conference in Europe, actually. The lawyers, you know, think that they aren't going to be able to win these cases, and lawyers are in the business of making money, so they don't think it's a good case, or they don't know how to argue it. And so, you know, oftentimes I'm hired by an attorney, not necessarily to write a report or to testify, but to just be in the background and help him strategize, him or her. So lawyers kind of shy away from these cases. So even if you want to file charges of something, it's hard to find an attorney who will take that case. And so there's so many obstacles to get through before we get to a victory like we had with Keith Raniere and NXIVM.
Mm-hmm.
And what was hopefully precedent setting about that case was the idea of coercion. And I know you have this new law in England that allows the use of the concept of coercion or coercive control in domestic situations. And so we need to expand that to organizational and cultic situations as well. And so mm-hmm. we have people here, you know, some young grad students and people who are working hard to also try to get those laws changed here, because I think that'll make a big difference.
And when you mention the FBI and Keith Raniere and him finally receiving his sentence, did you have were you first handedly involved in that process at all along the way?
Well, I was in New York for some of the trial, not all of the trial, not as an expert, but as an observer. And I was working with the two different documentaries, mm-hmm. one, The Vow, which was on HBO, and the other one was Cecilia Peck's Seduced. So I got to sit in the trial, you know, for I think 2 or 3 weeks every mm-hmm. day. And it was just astounding to see the evidence.
It must be for those that would speak against Keith Raniere as well. When you said that people don't like to do it because they're dragged through the coals, when I listen to anything sort of any kind of female on trial or involved in a trial, it's always straight to what kind of person she is, what men she slept with, or what women she slept right. with, and it always so right. so when you say kind of dragged over the coals, I imagine that in terms in, and in light of this cult specifically as well, it must have been absolutely traumatic for the victims to stand up and speak against him.
Absolutely. I mean, those women were so brave, those who spoke in the trial, and then later those who came and read victim impact statements. But in the trial, I swear there were days when even those of us in the audience were almost traumatized. I mean, the abuse, he was such a sadist, such a sadistic psychopath. And so the abuse and the torture and the things that were brought forward as evidence, and listening to him, you know, on these videos talk about these things like it's perfectly normal. I mean, he was such a slime ball. Mm-hmm. And so to see him sitting there, his smug little self, and you know, there were days I just, you know, was screaming when I got out of the courtroom. It was so intense. Mm-hmm. And those brilliant attorney, those two young prosecutors, you know, they were small, you know, thin women, you know, young, and they're just like tearing this guy apart. I mean, that was also just a really joyful part of it.
Yeah, I bet he never thought at the height of his success that he was ever going to be brought to justice by two women.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you think that NXIVM itself had all the key elements of turning into something even more dangerous than it was if it didn't get shut down?
Potentially, yes. I mean, I've seen people, you know, talk about on, you know, various websites and Twitter and things, you know, he was creating, or they had created this male group called Society of Protectors, and they were kind of putting them through a kind of military training. And Ranieri did have ideas about taking over the government. So I don't know that it ever would have gotten to that. But, you know, there's always that component when people are, you know, sort of indoctrinated to the point where they're deployable agents, just as Marines are deployable agents. You are given an order and you go and do it. When it gets to that point, especially with the kind of machismo and misogyny that they were projecting, I mean, it's, you know, it's not too much of a leap, I think, to imagine it could have gotten to a far more dangerous place. Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting when you mention, you know, having a vendetta against the government. I feel like all of the cases I've researched, Armshin Rikyo and Sinanon, for example, as soon as there becomes talk of wanting to take down the government or law enforcement or becoming their own entity for the law, you know, policing themselves, that's always sort of the tipping point where violence starts, and in these historical movements. So it was just an interesting point. I wondered, you know, we've seen such horrible things throughout history with so many unfortunate deaths of so many people. Yes. And you just wonder when and if it's going to happen again, and what movement it will be if it ever does. Obviously, of course, hopefully it doesn't.
So I assume you're talking about sort of, you know, mass suicides.
Yeah. Or just.
But also, I think, you know, a concern here, and I think also a concern in Europe, is the extremism of the right wing groups. You know, here it's the white supremacists and the racists and the nationalist groups that have kind of been, you know, given license under our current administration, which is happily about to leave, we hope.
hopefully, yeah, the sooner the better.
But we have to, yeah. But I think that those kinds of groups, I think, represent that kind of not internal danger, but external danger, because they're already armed, most of them. And violence is in their ideology. You know, I mean, the racists, you know, talk about a racial holy war. You know, that's part of their belief system. And so those groups and their counterparts in Europe, in Eastern Europe and everywhere, you know, I think that's a danger we need to stay on top of, because most cult groups don't act outwardly. I mean, you had Om Shinrikyo, which obviously, you know, had a much more megalomaniac, you know, idea to it. You know, you have some groups like that, but most cult groups are internal, and whatever harm goes on internally. And very few of them actually act out against society. They kind of keep to themselves and they brutalize their own members, but they kind of try to stay under the rug if they can, you know, out of the limelight. So it's only those, you know, it's only a certain percentage who are going to go the more violent route. Not that that is a small thing, but
no, it is interesting though, the way you've just summarized it. And I suppose that's what people find so fascinating about cults. It's the same with people that are really interested in serial killers. You know, you've got people that may commit one or two murders and it's kind of like, oh, that's interesting, but people that are, you know, like the Ted Bundys of the world that kill 20, 30, 40, 50, 100 plus, they're the fascinating cases. So even though I did a whole month on Jehovah's Witnesses, where I spoke to so many different ex-members from around the world, that was so fascinating for me to hear how similar their experiences were, but different depending on where they were living. That might not interest those who aren't looking for, they're looking for the big, horrible, gruesome mass suicide stories with, you know, lots of crazy cult stuff. And I think that's the big difference, isn't it? It's my understanding changes every day around what a cult is. And I speak to people who, one of the most interesting conversations I had was with a lady who was part of she had a Catholic family. She was from a very, very devout Catholic family. And the church that they attended itself wasn't cult-like, but the scripture was taken so delicately by the father that he implemented rules in the house that made the four-person household like a cult. And that to me, I never would have, before I started this podcast, I never would have thought that that was a thing, because my understanding of cults was
that's what I call a family cult.
So it does, so the term does exist.
Yes, well, in my book Take Back Your Life, I think we were the first to talk about family cults and one-on-one cults, and so they, you know, cults can exist in all types of formations. Absolutely.
And there was one news article I read the other day that had me thinking as well, about a Russian gamer who was streaming for his fans on the internet, and he ended up torturing his pregnant girlfriend until she died on the stream whilst his viewers paid to watch it, basically. And I thought that in itself has elements of cult-like behavior in a weird way. And then I started thinking if maybe the gaming community itself is a portal for that type of behavior and those things to exist. And then when I sat down and thought more about it, I realized that it just doesn't end, that it's not enclosed as a thing. They can exist anywhere with anyone and any amount of people.
That's a horrible story.
My goodness, it was absolutely tragic.
I see those things on, you know, on the crime shows that I watch, you know, Law and Order or whatever, but I you know, to think that happens in real time.
It's horrifying. It was live streamed on YouTube as well, and I just don't understand how that's even yeah. allowed to happen.
It's like those films. What are they called? Those films where the woman actually gets murdered.
Oh, snuff films.
Snuff films. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, modern day version of snuff films.
Absolutely. Yeah. Apparently, the stream itself had already made its way onto several platforms before YouTube even realized what was being streamed. So, that poor woman will just forever be in the corners of the worst parts of the internet.
Well, and you know, the point you're making is important, because really what cults cult leaders are using is basic social psychology, right? It's why I focus so much on the controls and influences, right? It's stuff that we're familiar with from the time we're little kids, right? You know, respect authority, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And so that's what makes it, you know, that's what makes it so easy for the cult to shape and conform someone, because these are things we're used to. I mean, very few cults actually use drugs, you know, like Manson did or Om Shinrikyo did, but cults don't need to use drugs. They just use basic social psychology. And that's why we can see the same elements in these other manifestations, like the one you're bringing up on the internet, because it's just, it's that way in which people are coerced and influenced.
And if from the comfort of their own homes as well, I suppose, it is a huge dynamic that's different. There isn't that element of somebody having to, you know, somebody moves to a new area for a new job and they don't know anyone, so they join the local book reading club or whatever, as an example, you know. And a lot of people in this day and age are too anxious or shy or introverted to put themselves in those situations, but now they don't need to, because they can find their own community group wherever in the world, you know.
We've seen that with QAnon, and I have, you know, so many other examples of, you know, people who've contacted me about, you know, someone in their family, their wife, whoever, who got involved in some kind of internet cult. I mean, it's, you know, I had a case where a husband was concerned about his ex-wife. She was spending literally like 20 hours a day on the internet watching these kind of UFO videos, and she believed she was going to be taken off to the fifth dimension. And she, as far as we could tell, there was no one person directing her. She was just enamored with these jillions of videos that are out there, and had convinced herself, you know, and was kind of living in this cult of one. And he was concerned about their kid. They had a child that they were, you know, co-parenting. I'm joint custody, and you know, the son was coming to his place and starting to talk about UFOs and
oh my god,
because that's all the mom did. I mean, she, other than take the kid to school, she spent all her time on the computer. And so, it, like you say, it's easy to just, especially now during this pandemic when we're sheltered in, you know, people end up in these alternate realities.
Absolutely.
Very frightening.
Yep.
The future is a hefty responsibility, and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
And that actually leads me perfectly onto my next point. I reached out to the cult subreddit, and I mentioned that I was going to be speaking to an expert, and I asked if any of the users on the subreddit had any questions. So some people got back to me and offered me some really interesting questions. And the first one was, I'm curious about the idea of leaderless cults like QAnon and other social media groups. Do you think a movement being leaderless automatically disqualifies it from being able to operate as a cult?
No. Even with QAnon, though, there supposedly is somebody who is Q. But I guess in that sense, you know, the idea becomes the leader in a sense. I mean, I think we also saw that with bin Laden, Osama bin Laden, where Al-Qaeda was so widespread, and bin Laden was kind of a figurehead, but it was really the ideology of jihad that people were wedded to. And so I think we can see that same kind of blind followership and sort of, you know, total devotion to an idea. And then the impact and the importance of peer pressure. You know, you belong to this community that's urging you on.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That sounds exactly like the Jehovah's Witnesses, because when I was speaking to the ex-members, they obviously they worship Jehovah as their godhead, but they never had one particular person involved or in charge. Even the congregations would be run by a number of elders, not just one. So,
right, but they do have the governing body.
They do have the governing body. So it was interesting for me because I was thinking, is there one individual leader? And if there is, would that be Jehovah? But no, because there's a group of men sitting in a room who are kind of, they are the ones who are saying exactly how things will be run and the changes and on all of that stuff. So even there's not one leader, but there is a group of men dictating.
And originally there was a founder and a leader, you know, and so it's his writings and his words that they carry on. And so the governing body has what we call charisma by proxy. You know, they become the charismatic leader because they've been endowed with this authority. And so mm-hmm. they're able to orchestrate what they want to happen by, you know, by dint of having that power mm-hmm. that was mm-hmm. given to them.
That is, yeah, I can see that perfectly now. I'm learning so much and I'm really enjoying it. And it's interesting about the Jehovah's Witnesses as well, because there's a lot in the news at the moment and a lot of speculation that they are going to lose their
in Australia.
Yeah, their exemption status.
Yes, yes.
So and there's been a lot of court cases over here as well about child abuse and neglect as well. So it's not looking very good for the movement itself at the moment. Which everybody over on the XJW subreddit, which has been the most wholesome place to be a part of recently, everybody's holding their breath, hoping for the best, especially because some of them are physically in, mentally out. And they, you know, don't want to be ostracized from the rest of their family and friends. So they're kind of sticking with it for the time being. Right. But they're all putting pictures up of their Christmas trees and Christmas jumpers and celebrating birthdays and Halloween. And everybody's saying, you know, this is my first birthday cake or this is my first pumpkin carving. And it's honestly, it's the most joyful and wholesome place to see people who are 40, 50, 60 having these experiences for the first time. So, yeah, that's been lovely.
You know, if I might mention, and I don't know if you've mentioned this elsewhere, but I was part of a documentary series on A&E, and it's now on Hulu. So for whoever has Hulu, and it's 9 parts, and it's called Cults and Extreme Belief.
Yes. Yeah.
So you have talked about this. So we
haven't talked about it, but I am aware of it. Yeah.
Yeah, and so we covered 7 different cults, including the Jehovah's Witnesses.
Okay.
And then in the last 2 episodes, which is really wonderful, we brought together the former members who were in the other episodes who hadn't met each other before. We kept them all separate in the hotels and stuff. And then we had, you know, kind of a support session with them. And so I was a consulting producer on that whole series. And I'm in most of the episodes, not all of them, but it's really a great series because you see after a while, these different cults doing the same thing, only calling it something else, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So you get to see these patterns of structure and behavior.
I guess that does lead me nicely onto my next question as well, which might be a bit controversial for some people listening, I'm not sure. But one user asked, if Jesus was alive today, do you think he would be considered a cult leader?
Probably so. I would say, you know, more in the classic sense of a sect and, you know, a sort of offshoot. But he was, you know, he was clearly a charismatic leader. People were clearly devoted to him and followed mm-hmm. him wherever. And he professed, you know, or the writings about him later, you know, professed miracles and whatnot. And so there's, you know, there's all that mystical beginnings of the virgin birth and things like that. So yes, I suppose he
mm-hmm.
would.
Mm-hmm. I myself am atheist. So I always try and make sure I'm not. I don't know. It's difficult, isn't it? Because I will sit here and say Jehovah's Witnesses are bad, but then I'm also like, oh, Christianity is a bit. I don't know. It's a difficult one because you never want to openly offend somebody, but at the same time, it's difficult when you don't understand their belief system, which I guess is why it would be difficult to have a conversation with somebody who's indoctrinated in the first place. Mm-hmm. But the next question is, well, this next one was something that really interested me. It says, does our school system train young people in a way that predisposes them to cult membership? In a school, you are taught to blindly follow authority, suppress emotions, suppress physical needs, and ask permission to use the toilet. Above all else, you are taught to follow the group.
Well, I don't know what school that is, because that sounds like a cult school if you have to suppress your emotions and follow blindly. I mean, hopefully, you know, yes, schools socialize you and they teach you to respect authority. But hopefully they also teach you critical thinking. And I think our schools could teach a lot more critical thinking mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. so that children and teens learn to question in a respectful way. I think unless it's a cult school, hopefully they're not teaching you to just follow the group, but they're helping you kind of de-individuate and find yourself and find the things you're interested in and that you want to do with your life. And whether it's, you know, math or art or science or whatever, you have these different experiences. And within that, there's the socialization of how to get along and not be a bully and, you know, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I don't think, you know, as I said, I think if anything, our schools could teach more critical thinking. But I don't think they're necessarily the source of why people get into cults.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That's the question.
And the last one that I had was, have you experienced those who are indoctrinated into cults showing signs of psychosis while they are under the influence of control?
Yes, absolutely. We call those brief psychotic episodes. And one of the problems with these psychotic breaks that can happen is that often if a person ends up in a hospital or getting medical attention, the person gets diagnosed as being psychotic and given a bunch of drugs, and it can really affect them forever to have that kind of diagnosis when what they're really having is a brief psychotic episode, meaning that something that was going on in the cult or the way in which they were controlled, you know, has caused a break in their psyche for the moment. It doesn't mean that they're forever mentally ill. They need to pass through that episode. They definitely do need to get help to get through that episode, but it doesn't mean they're, you know, mentally ill forever and ever, or were mentally ill to begin with. And so, you know, that's one of the reasons why I write my books, is hopefully to help professionals understand this difference so that people aren't misdiagnosed and given the wrong treatment.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But yes, seeing those kind of a psychotic break, which is essentially a break from reality. That's what a psychotic break is. That happens all the time mm-hmm. to people in cults.
And when you talk about, you know, people being taken to hospital and needing medical attention, that could be the opportunity for them to have that cognitive dissonance. And if they're then plied with a load of drugs overwhelming their system, I suppose that's just going to put them into even more of a detached state where they're not going to be able to have that period of, oh, actually, now that I've taken a step back, or now that I'm able to get a good amount of sleep or eat a good meal, or whatever the situation may be.
Right. And that's why I think, you know, people who are like emergency workers and, you know, kind of the frontline people in these situations, the ER people in hospitals, I don't know if you call it the same over there, emergency rooms, you know, those types of professions are people who need to be trained, just like with human trafficking, to be able to recognize the victims when they come in and perhaps get them to open up and start talking and be able to provide some empathy and understanding, rather than just, you know, shove them back to the cult or back to the trafficker.
And we touched briefly on some movements that are completely cut off or isolated, you know, from anything and everyone else. And this question I've asked all of the people I've interviewed pretty much since March, April of this year. Do you think that the COVID-19 pandemic has affected the way cult groups have been able to function in terms of the ones that work within our communities and the ones that are cut off from our communities?
Yes, I think, you know, I think COVID has affected all of us in so many different ways. And so, of course, it's also affected the cults. I think on a number of different levels. I think, you know, because of fear and panic, you know, that's when people join cults, when people are, you know, upset, when societies are in turmoil, that's when cults can really thrive and recruit, right? Because here's somebody who's offering you an answer. It can also make people who might be thinking of leaving their group fearful of leaving because, oh my God, look what's happening out there, right? So there's that that can pressure you. It certainly has an impact both, I think, on recruitment and on leaving. And I think for people who, you know, have someone who is in a cult, it's made it harder to have any kind of contact or communication. I mean, you know, imagine you were someone who was able to see your loved one, you know, once a month or something. Well, you know, that's not happening anymore because you're in lockdown. So it may increase the isolation. So it can have a lot of negative effects. I can't think of too many positive effects because it's hard to think of any positive effects of this damn pandemic.
Well, I was thinking that there would be less, mostly just going back to the Jehovah's Witnesses again, there's been a lot less pioneering and door-to-door work.
Yes.
So I imagine, and I know that a lot of religious congregations haven't been able to get together as much as possible. A lot of things are taking place over the internet and people are kind of finding themselves a bit like, oh, I don't know if I'm going to attend service this week. But those were the only positives, and I've been talking about this for almost a year now, so those are literally the only ones that we've been able to draw also, on.
I don't know about over there, but here so many of the really fundamentalist churches are like defying all the COVID restrictions and still having these giant baptisms.
No, we haven't had that over here, but we do watch it on the news and we all kind of...
It's really big over here.
Yeah, you know, we just watch with our hands on our
These
on
pastors
our heads.
Are kind of dying off one after another. You know, it's like, oh, doesn't, you know, God's going to protect us and boom, he's dead next week. So, but that has definitely been one of the negative consequences of those churches that have defied the restrictions.
Yeah. And they all seem to, the way that America has come across to us in the news this year as well, is that they all seem to be almost connected all the way back to Trump every time for some reason. It's always like this church is still getting together and here's Trump, and this church is still meeting and here's Trump. And even though it's not saying that the two are actually hand in hand, it just seems to be the way that the news is presented to us. I don't know, it's just been...
Well, no, I mean, they you know, some of them take their guidance from the leader, and for some of them he's considered their leader. I mean, for some of them they think he's God, you know, so there's been all kinds of nonsense.
Well, I think he thinks he might be God as well.
Yes, well, I don't know if he even thinks, but yeah, it's a dangerous situation for sure. Almost over.
Hopefully. I mean, well, this vaccination's the next step, isn't it? This and then him moving out of office.
Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, yeah.
As soon as possible, 3 years ago. So I often speak to people who I mentioned before are physically in their movement, but mentally out. And they may choose to stay because of fear of losing their family or shunning from you know, friends and loved ones. Or sometimes they have businesses and work ties within their group or congregation. Is there any advice you can give to those people who are, you know, maybe listening to this podcast on the cusp of kind of making that decision?
Yeah, you know, I didn't leave my group for a long time because, not because of the leader or not because of the belief system, but because of my comrades. You know, I would think, how can I leave and leave everyone behind? How can I leave when I recruited this one and that one and criticized this one and that one? But, you know, in retrospect, I think, I know that, you know, especially for people with families, it's something you really cherish, and it's a tough call. I mean, I think if you think there's any chance that your family will leave with you, you know, work on that. But at some point, I think you have to bite the bullet and you have to trust your gut and go with your gut. And as hard as that may be, I mean, that move may actually inspire others to leave. It may inspire, you know, a breakthrough for your family or for, you know, whatever. And, you know, you can have a new life again. You can start a business again, a career. I mean, you can, you know, there is a whole world out there which the cult has gotten you to forget about. And so I guess my advice would be, you know, I can't tell anyone what to do, but I would say just think very carefully about the pros and cons and try to, you know, save yourself as much as you can.
Yeah. And you mentioned that it took yourself years, you know, to move away entirely. So even if a person does decide to leave, and it seems like their family and friends aren't going to ever change their minds or make that decision, it may just be that they take the same amount of time, same period of time, you know, to come to that decision as well. So even though it might not be an immediate decision for friends and family to join you and make that transition with you, that's not to say that they never will.
Exactly. Yeah.
And if people do find themselves successfully moving away from the movement and they are having to transition back to typical life, And for some of these, some of these people could be children who have never experienced typical life. Is there any advice or guidance or resources you would direct people to in terms of helping them to make that transition?
Well, naturally, my books.
Yes, absolutely.
I don't like to self-promote, but my book, Take Back Your Life, has helped, you know, at this point, probably thousands of people. Mm-hmm. I mean, I still get messages from around the world. And I'm about to put that book in audio format, which is a big coup.
With yourself reading the book?
No, I won't be reading.
Oh, that's unfortunate.
I know, that's what they say, but I cough too much, you know. So. It would take forever. So Take Back Your Life is, you know, I think a really helpful resource for people because it's very practical.
Yeah.
You know, and then for people who were born or raised in a group, my other book, Escaping Utopia, growing up in a cult, getting out and starting over is kind of the counterpart to Take Back Your Life, because people who are born in the group have different experiences and have different issues to deal with when they get out. And then I would say, you know, try to find yourself a good support group. Supportive people around you who aren't going to judge you and aren't, you know, and who will just kind of let you be and be with you. And then depending on where you are and your resources, I would say try to find a therapist who, a good kind of cognitive behavioral therapist, none of this gimmicky stuff, who's familiar with cult after effects, who can work with you. You can always have the therapist read my book if they're not familiar. And if they don't want to read the book, then that's not a good therapist for you. And I would say, again, depending on where you are, finding a support group of former cult members. And now, I mean, I even have one that I'm doing on Zoom now every other Saturday. So there's the one thing the pandemic has brought us is Zoom. And so, there are several different support groups. There's one that comes out of London as well. Support groups have been phenomenally helpful for people because they see they're not alone. They aren't the only one who went through this kind of thing. Because when you get out of a cult, you just feel like an alien. You just feel like you know, like nobody understands you. Nobody gets it. You're ashamed. You don't want to talk about it, or you talk too much about it. I mean, it's just like so much. And being able to have other people who've been through, doesn't have to be the same cult, because they will have experienced a similar kind of things. And so, you know, I guess, and then, you know, I think the best advice I can give is just be kind to yourself. Like, don't blame yourself. Don't feel guilty. I know you will blame yourself. I know you will feel guilty, but try to be kind to yourself and just, you know, try to sleep, relax, eat well, take care of yourself. It depending again on how long you're in a group, it's gonna take a while, and so you need to really take care of yourself during this time.
And would you say that it should be expected for people to feel the effects of this group years after leaving it?
Oh, absolutely. It's like any other kind of deep experience. It's like, you know, if you get married and then you get divorced, you don't ever forget that you were once married to that person, and you may go somewhere and there may be reminders. So there will be these things we call triggers, where you may hear a voice or you may hear a song and it may, you know, make you remember something, or you may have, you know, emotional reactions that are kind of left over from the cult. I still have that 35 years later. They don't dominate me, and I recognize them, and I know how to control them. But, you know, any kind of traumatic experience is going to stay with you. So again, it's what you do with it.
Yeah.
You know, and learning to recognize it and do the things that you need to do to keep yourself healthy.
I just think that's perfectly said. I've gone through all of my questions, so I didn't know if there was anything you wanted to add before I direct our listeners towards some of your fantastic work.
Not really. I just, you know, it's really been an honor for me to do this work. And I guess I have a question for you. Like, how did you get interested in cults?
Oh, well, I was, I really wanted to start a podcast. I have for years, and I really didn't know what I wanted the podcast to be about. And I listened to a few true crime podcasts, and I thought maybe I'd do one on true crime podcasts or something similar. And then one of my friends said, I've been reading about Scientology, and I think it's the most fascinating thing that I've ever stumbled upon. And it's such a rabbit hole. And I thought to myself, rabbit holes, that's what I want. I want to be able to, you know, read a news article and then go further and further and further and further. So it started off as me kind of doing deep dives and research episodes and projects on cults from around the world and throughout history. And then I found that people really wanted to share their experiences and talk. And it's been so enriching for me, but also I feel quite cathartic for the interviewees as well to speak about their experiences. Mm-hmm. So now the podcast has become something completely different. And my weekly episodes are me speaking with survivors of different movements. Yeah, that's it was just me on maternity leave wanting something to do in the evenings, you know, wanting to be able to, I suppose there are those of us out there who always have a yearning for learning. And I graduated a few years ago now in a completely different field. And I found myself wanting to sit down and research and make notes and bullet points and lists and all that good stuff and nice stationery. So I just thought a podcast would be the way to go. And so here we are. And I sit in these episodes and I speculate with the people I speak with about what I think may have happened or direct them to different resources of different experts. But I've never been able to sit down and speak to somebody who's had years in the field and can tell me if my train of thought is right or why things happen a certain way. And that's what you've given me in these last couple of hours. And I just cannot thank you enough for the experience. It's been fantastic to be able to sit down with somebody who has such a wealth of knowledge and information and experience.
Well, thanks. I've really enjoyed it.
Yeah. So for anybody that is interested in more of Janya's work, we've talked a lot about your website, which is cultresearch.org.
Right.
And we've talked about your TED-Ed animation that you've done, which I'm going to post the link to in the show notes. There's a number of documentaries. We've mentioned the Seduced NXIVM cult documentary, the Cult and Extreme Belief, which is on Hulu, which is a 9-part series.
Mm-hmm.
And there's the Take Back Your Life book, which is on Amazon. And all your stuff's on Amazon. But that is the first thing that will come up if you type Janya Lalić into the Amazon search bar, the Take Back Your Life book.
And my more theoretical book just got brought back into print. So I was excited about that. It's Bounded Choice.
Choice.
Yeah, True Believers and Charismatic Cults. It's University of California Press. It's basically a kind of a user-friendly version of my dissertation.
But
it's my theory, Bounded Choice, which is kind of a counter to the brainwashing theory, because brainwashing is such a buzzword and has been
Here it is.
Yeah.
There we go. Wow, that must be so exciting when people get in touch with you and tell you that they're printing more of your more of your things. Wow, that's fantastic. Yep, so that's on Amazon now as well. You can order that immediately. I just wanted to say quickly before I finish the call, thank you so much for your time, your wisdom, your expertise, and just for all of the work that you're doing in your field as well, and for all the thousands of people that you've helped and continue to help. I hope that you get to be a part of more expert witness testimonies and court cases and bring justice to these people. And I hope that you get to travel as soon as possible as well, because you said you enjoy it, and it must be difficult if you're used to jet setting, being stuck in the same place. So just thank you so much for all of your time, Janya. And I really, really hope that you enjoy the rest of your day.
Oh, thank you. And this was wonderful. I'm so glad we got to do this. So
fantastic. I will let you know when the episode is live. But for now, I wish you full health, and I will speak to you soon.
Thank you. And get vaccinated.
Oh, I will do. Yeah, everybody get vaccinated. Yeah.
That is the end of this week's episode. For all of the sources and materials listed, I have shared them in the episode description. If you'd like to get in touch, you can do so by emailing me at cultvaultpodcast@gmail.com or finding me on Twitter and Instagram at cultvaultpod. I'm your speaker, Casey, and this has been The Cult Vault.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.